Welcome to another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. Today I'm delighted to be talking with Victoria Moran. She is the best-selling author of 10 books, an international speaker on wellness and personal growth, and a certified life coach specializing in spiritual life coaching. Victoria's latest book is Fat, Broke, and Lonely No More. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you so much.
Well, I have to tell you, I bought the book, Fat, Broke, and Lonely No More, feeling like I wasn't any of those things. And then I picked it up and I started reading and I was like, well, you know, this all kind of fits with me. I just love it. I'm wondering if you can talk to our listeners about what it's about and how it touches a lot of folks.
Sure, thank you. You know, that was not my title. It was actually my editor's idea. And when he first said it, he said, Fat, Broke, and Lonely. And my thought was, bleh. But as soon as I got over that initial reaction, I knew exactly what it was about. And it's about emptiness on the inside. Mm. And certainly we can fill that emptiness in all kinds of ways. I mean, he could have called me and said, do you want to write a book called Drunk, Bummed, and Dissed, or Starving Myself, Scared to Death, and Sleeping Around. It's the idea of this inner emptiness, which is not abnormal. I think we come to this earth with this kind of emptiness so that we'll search for meaning. And yet, it's kind of gone from that essential emptiness that's a part of the human condition to a sort of epidemic emptiness in which we think we're supposed to be perfect. And so we reach for food or diets or spending money or hoarding money or running around with all kinds of people who may not be good for us or isolating from people, all these extremes to try to get that inner balance. So Fat, Broke, and Lonely, No More.
Yeah.
It's about adding on the no more and filling the empty hole.
Well, it's great. I love it. I read it on New Year's Day, I think, and I found it just a perfect way to begin the new year.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks.
Well, over the past few weeks since I first encountered you, I've been looking at your books and your website, and I'm just impressed. You've built this incredible writing career that includes these best-selling books and articles in high-profile magazines. Maybe you could talk to our listeners about how you got started.
Sure. I've always been a writer, and I think it's a little bit like acting. And I've heard many times over the years, actors will go on those late-night talk shows, and the host will say, what is your advice to a young actor? Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, if you can possibly do anything else, do it.
Yeah.
It's such a tough business and so hard. Now, writing wasn't always that difficult. It used to be that you could be a writer. It's hard to just be a writer nowadays, especially in nonfiction, which is my genre. You almost have to be a something and a writer. And yet, that kind of takes something away from the purity of being somebody who is at home with words. I've always been at home with words. From the time I was a little kid, I had one gift, and it was the English language, spoken and written. So even though I know a lot of people are very, very gifted and they have all kinds of things they could do in the world, I've always known that I can only do words. So the only conflict I had was, am I going to be a writer or am I going to be some kind of performer or speaker or something like that? And what I've actually become is both. I write and I do motivational speaking, and that's a wonderful, wonderful marriage. And it's actually good now for being a writer because nonfiction authors certainly are expected to be able to speak. And that's kind of unfair because just because you can write doesn't necessarily mean that you can speak or that you want to speak. That does seem to be part of it. But I'm wandering from your question, how I got started. I've always been able to do this. Words are my medium. I think in words, I live in words, I dream in words. So I'd always written, and when I was 14, I sent a dollar to a teen magazine called Teen Life and got myself a press card, which thousands of other little girls also had. But I took mine very seriously, and I thought that I was supposed to meet the Beatles. That was my goal. So I had my little press card, and I got in touch with the editor of the magazine, and we got in touch with the Beatles press agent when they were coming to my hometown of Kansas City. And sure enough, at age 14, I got into my first Beatles press conference, looked out the hotel window at thousands of girls my age who were standing across the street behind a barricade, and I'm thinking, this writing thing is cool.
That's great.
This will take you places. And that was really the beginning of writing for publication, and I've been doing it ever since. I've been doing it full-time with no other job since 1989.
Wow. Well, talk a little bit about the bridge from starting writing to full-time. What are some of the steps that you took to make writing, something that you could make a living with, and
yeah,
things that maybe our listeners who are not making a living could put into practice?
Well, I think I made a lot of mistakes, and I also had the blessing of starting out earlier. If I were starting out now, it is tougher. In some ways, it's easy because there are blogs and there are websites and there are so many ways to get your work out there. What's harder is getting paid for getting your work out there. But what I did, I started freelancing, you know, in high school and that, and then I did get a job writing. My first job in writing was writing ads for a department store. And that was good training because that taught me how to write short and succinct and snappy. And then I had a job at a local magazine in Kansas City called The Independent. It's the weekly journal of society. So I wrote about engagements and parties that I wasn't invited to and trips of people that I would never socialize with and weddings and obituaries. And because it was a weekly, we were writing all the time. I can remember that there was kind of a little lull on Thursday morning where we'd breathe, and by Thursday afternoon we were back in that grind. I had that job for 4 years, and then I got married, moved away, was gone for 5 or 6 years, came back and had that job for another 2 years, and that's really where I learned how to write. And I think it's like anything else. If you do it and do it and do it over and over again, especially under the pressure of deadlines, you learn how to do it. And especially because in that particular job, it was a very specific genre, and we were writing about the same things over and over again. I mean, it's how many ways can you say Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so went to, you know, Cabo San something or other and stayed at this nice hotel and met with Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so and so-and-so over and over again. But that was the training, to take that and make it sound fresh and new. So I was very, very fortunate to have that job.
Wow, that, you know, that's a perfect lead into another question I had. I noticed that the writing in Fat, Broken, Lonely, No More is so fresh and lively. And I wondered how you keep your writing fresh after writing 10 basically self-help books, you know, books in the same genre.
Yeah.
You know, how do you not begin to kind of put your books into a formula and just kind of say the same thing over and over, get tired prose,
right,
or whatever?
Well, you know, I'm sure that many of the ideas do get repackaged because I am a writer, but I also consider myself a philosopher who writes. I do write in the self-help field, some about wellness and that sort of thing, but basically for me it's spirituality. When my degree is in comparative religions, I went to college late and everybody said, well, why didn't you major in journalism or English? And it's like, well, why? I've been writing for all these years. I want to major in something that I'm interested in. But I really do feel that I have a message. And I think there are only so many ramifications of a message. You know, there are only so many ways you can package it. And yet I think what you're really asking about is style. And it's so important for a writer to claim your style. And your style doesn't have to be like somebody else's style. And I think if you think about writers that you like, whether it's contemporary writers, whether it's journalists, whether it's even, you know, classic fiction writers of all the ages, there are certain styles that appeal to you. And my style, I believe, was forged through many years of my mid-childhood and adolescence of reading fashion magazines and women's magazines. I was a fat kid, and I was always looking for a way to be thinner and more attractive. So I started reading those magazines when I was 10. And they have a snappy, upbeat kind of style. And that's, I believe, what has infused my style. So even if I'm writing about something very deep and philosophical and spiritual, that's my style. And some people love it, you know, and some people probably think it's pedestrian and too light for what I'm talking about and, you know, whatever they might think. But my audience likes it, and you only need to appeal to your audience.
Well, you know, that kind of fits in with another thing I noticed about your book, is that your books tend to have a lot of short chapters. And I wondered what you saw as the benefits of both writing and reading short chapters.
Well, it's interesting. It's been very good for me for the past 10 years, and I'm actually writing another short chapter book right now. My best-selling book is the one called Creating a Charmed Life. That came out in the spring of 1999, and it's done amazing things. It did not get media to speak of, but just by word of mouth, it's sold very, very well. It continues to sell very well. It's quoted on boxes of Celestial Seasonings teas, and it's in 28 languages around the world. So that's my honey. You know, that's the book that kind of keeps me on the map, and I've been commissioned by Harper One to do a sequel, which will be out in April of 2009, and we're not real sure of the title yet, but it's something about a charmed life. And that will also be, as all my books have been since that first short chapter book, more short chapters. Now, whether I'm going to go on like that for many more books, I'm not sure. How that came about for me was I had proposed a book, this Creating a Charmed Life book, but it was going to be a regular, I think, 12-chapter book, like my previous books had been and like most books were. But if you can think back, if you're interested in the self-help genre at all, to what was going on in 1996, well, what was going on was Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
Yep, absolutely.
It was a phenomenon around the world. It was the fastest-selling book of all time, and it was the top-selling book in all genres for 2 years straight, and both of those things are records that have not been broken. So I think the publishers were all thinking, oh, this is it. This is the wave of the future. Let's do more of these short chapter things. And interestingly enough, Dr. Richard Carlson, bless his soul, he did pass away last year, wrote the preface to Creating a Charmed Life. Mm. So that was kind of interesting that, you know, they wanted his format and he was gracious enough to write my foreword. So the great thing about short chapters is that the attention span of the human being has diminished a lot in the past 30 years. And also, we're just so busy. I was talking with my husband yesterday about the complexity of simple things that if I think back even a dozen years ago, you know, what bills did I pay? You know, there was the mortgage and the light bill and the phone bill and the health insurance. And that was about it. And now, you know, there's for the email and the newsletter and the cell phone and the cable TV and which bill do you write a check for and which one comes out of the bank and which one goes on to the American Express. And it's just so complex. So people like to get their wisdom, their little bit of inspiration in a short snippet. In fact, I get wonderful emails from people who say, I love your books. I keep them in my bathroom. And I say, you know, thank you, I think. So that's the great part. The other side of that, and a reason that I think, you know, one of these years I do want to get back to the more traditional sized chapters, is that there's a lot to be said for depth and really giving somebody something that they have to work at a little bit. And I think particularly in the arena that I write in, the arena of spiritual and personal growth, sometimes we need to challenge ourselves, and I'd like to do a little bit of that in the future.
Great. Well, now, can you talk a little bit more about this idea of writing either a sequel or a companion? I notice you have a couple of companion books, and now you're writing a sequel. What are the benefits and the challenges of either writing a companion or a sequel to a nonfiction self-help book?
Okay, I haven't really done a companion book. I think you're talking about Fit From Within and Lit From Within.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have similar titles. Actually, they're even from different publishers.
Wow.
Lit From Within is about bringing out your inner beauty. That one had the good fortune of being on Oprah in 2001. And, you know, that is very good fortune for a writer, no question about it. And then the next book that I wanted to do had to do with weight loss and the inner side of weight loss. And my publisher, who's published most of my books, Harper One, they used to be called Harper San Francisco, It just wasn't their kind of book because they're a spiritual publishing house. They're the San Francisco arm of HarperCollins, and they specialize in spirituality and religion. So the idea of a weight loss book, even a weight loss book from the inside out, just really wasn't for them. So we did go to McGraw-Hill for Fit From Within. I didn't see it as a companion to Lit From Within so much. In fact, I think when I originally proposed it, it didn't even have that title. That just sort of grew. I think what a lot of people don't realize is that when you are published by a publishing house, your title changes many, many times, and it's usually the publishing house that has the final say on title. So those titles happen to sound alike, but I didn't write them really as companions. I wanted Fit From Within because it comes from my experience, and I think a really important thing for a writer, particularly if you're writing about how to live, you know, what I have learned from life and what I would like to share with you is some issues are just really, really important to you as an individual. And those are the things that you can write about with the most passion. And because I grew up with a lot of trouble with weight, my dad was a diet doctor, my mother was in the weight loss business, and I was a fat kid. And it took me until my early 30s to really get a handle on that one. And when I did, it was so profound and such a blessing in my life and such a shift to see that I could live without either eating for a fix or being tied to some awful diet that it was just an amazing thing. And that had been going on in my life, the recovery from the overeating, for something like 18 years when I wrote Fit From Within. So that was really the culmination. I saw that book as a gift to anybody who wanted the kind of recovery that I had. You know, and people all want different things. You know, when that book came out, it was picked by a Parade magazine for their Better Living Bazaar, and I really thought, oh, boy, this is going to be the set the world on fire. You know, this is going to be the Atkins or the Fit for Life or the whatever, you know, that everybody is going to grab. Well, it's done very well and continues to do well, but it's not the everybody grab, and I think it's because it's not the kind of quick fix. And one thing that I think all of us as writers have to understand is that there are certain people we are supposed to touch. And by the grace of God, may we touch enough that we can make a living. Beyond that, I'm not sure what we can expect. So I'm just grateful for all my readers, and I hope I'm answering your question. I think I had too much tea for lunch. I feel that I'm...
Oh, you're great. You're great. Well, let's move into that thing about the sequel then. Tell me about what it's like to write a sequel to Charmed Life.
Yeah, well, I'm just beginning. And I spoke yesterday with a wonderful mentor of mine, maybe someone you would like to have on your program at some point. His name is Gerald Mundus. His best-known book is How to Get Out of Debt, Stay Out of Debt, and Live Prosperously. Mm. That's a perennial bestseller. He's also done fiction. He's done all sorts of things. And he is a masterful writer's coach. He helps people unblock. Unblock.org is how people could find him if they feel blocked and would like to read some of his stuff. And I did his unblocking workshop years and years ago and was talking to him the other day about, you know, the sequel thing is really difficult because Creating a Charmed Life has been my biggest book. And I'm feeling like this one has to be at least that good. And that's really scary. And he uses this wonderful analogy that I'm just very happy to quote and share with your listeners. He said, you can't look at your writing like the whole freight train. The idea that that engine has to pull a car that is be as good as the last one, and then another card that says sell X number of copies, and another card that says make my publisher love me and want to take my next book, and another card that says make me rich and famous, because that's an awful lot to put on that little engine of sitting down every day and writing. And he said you have to uncouple the engine of your writing from all those cars. And at one point, I actually bought a little toy train that had the engine and each of those cars connected by little magnets. And every day at Jerry Mundis's suggestion, when I would start to write, I would remove the engine from all those cars and just write without having any of that stuff attached to it. And it's so freeing because the muse doesn't show up because you want to sound good or you want to be famous or whatever. The muse shows up for her own sake, and that's uncoupling the engine.
Oh, that's great. Well, it's great to hear you talk about people who have inspired you. I'm wondering if you could share with our readers any leaders or writers or thinkers that have been inspirational to you or any books that you recommend to new writers?
You know, there are so many. I'm particularly inspired in my own genre, the spirituality field. Someone who crosses over spirituality and writing is Natalie Goldberg. I love her stuff. It's Natalie Goldberg who convinced me that I need to be writing in cafes. Mm. I do have a home office. It's where I do all of my work in terms of marketing and all the clerical stuff and where I talk to my life coaching clients and book my speaking and all that. But when I actually write, I need to go out to a Starbucks or a somewhere and get the energy of the people, but I need to be where nobody can bother me. I'm not set up to do email out in the world, and so that's just for writing. So Natalie Goldberg, Writing Down the Bones, is wonderful. Some of the books and authors that have inspired me in my own genre, Gary Zukav's Seat of the Soul is a very important book to me. A lot of the Deepak Chopra stuff I adore, particularly, and it may even be his very first book, Perfect Health, which is an explanation of Ayurvedic health and healing, has been so profound to me. I read it periodically, every couple of years as I kind of fall away from some of those practices and feel like, why am I so tired? It's like, oh, wait a minute, you're not doing your Ayurvedic stuff, and I go back to that book, and that's good. One that I recently rediscovered, and this is so much fun, because you know when you love a book or you love an author, and then you're away from them for a long time, and you get back together, it's kind of like getting back with your high school boyfriend or something.
Oh, yeah, that's
it's
true.
Very exciting. And I was out in Kansas City, my hometown, staying with another writer friend, Barbara Bartocci, who writes a wonderful book. She's doing a series now called Grace on the Go. So she has, the grace for dieters and grace for new moms and grace for caregivers. And she reminded me of a writer named Thomas Powers that I had been profoundly impressed with and by in the early 1980s, and I've moved a lot. So my library does not get to grow and grow as a writer's library should, but Thomas Powers wrote a book called Invitation to a Great Experiment, and the great experiment is that one can have an experiential awareness of God, which is basically how to become a mystic, which to me is about the most exciting thing on earth. So I'm rereading Invitation to a Great Experiment, and I love it. And, you know, some books just have little quirky things that make you adore them. And Invitation to a Great Experiment has on its frontispiece a wonderful, profound, spiritual piece of art. What do you think it is?
I don't know.
It's an alarm clock. And he says that if you want to have this profound experience of the divine, you need to set your alarm clock for an hour earlier every morning.
Wow.
And get up. And he suggests 20 minutes of reading, 20 minutes of prayer or meditation, and 20 minutes of exercise. And this was really fun for me to read because I write in Fat, Broken, Lonely, No More, about something that I came up with, which I call Me in the Morning, that if you think about me, first thing in the morning, and that is an acronym, M for meditation, E for exercise, and get that stuff in before the world takes over, you're going to have a lot better day. And I was just thrilled to death that this person that I have admired for a long time has a similar kind of take on things.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Certainly.
Well, you talked a little bit about your work as a spiritual life coach and your work as a speaker. Can you talk about how those two things interact with your work as a writer and vice versa?
Yeah. Well, you know, part of it is just practical, that it's hard to make a living just writing. I know some people are just remarkable at being able to repackage things and write a magazine article about one topic and then just tweak it a little bit and sell it five more times. I so admire those people. I find that so that I don't feel forced to write books. See, I think a book is a very sacred thing, and I never want to write a book just because I need the money. I want to write books because it's a book that needs to be written. So for me to be able to make enough money to stay afloat and be a viable part of my family unit, I need to be doing some other things. The speaking, I've always done. I mean, I started writing for publication at 14. I started speaking for the local Rotary clubs and things like that when I was 12. So I've always done this. But I really started taking it seriously about 10, 11 years ago, joined the National Speakers Association and got a handle on this related but very separate business. When I first went to National Speakers, I thought I was pretty cool. I'd already written, you know, 5 books, I think, and, you know, I'd been around the block a few times. And this woman said to me, "This is an entirely different industry from publishing. In other words, sit down, shut up, and learn. You don't know this business." And that was very wise. I mean, I didn't think it was great at the time, but it was good. And in that association, I learned something that was worth paying dues to that organization for the years that I was a part of it. And that was when somebody said, "A public speaker gives speeches. A professional speaker weaves stories together." Well, there's nothing more pleasing to the ears of a writer than what we want you to do is tell stories. And that has made a huge difference in my speaking career. And it's all very recyclable. You know, the stories that I use in my speaking either come out of my books or they go into my books, one way or the other. So nothing is wasted. But it's wonderful if you are, you know, the idea is that writers are all introverts and that we were the kids, you know, with the thick glasses who wanted to stay in from recess and erase the blackboard so we could have more time to be with our books and that. And I think there's some truth to that to varying degrees for all of us. But just because you're a writer doesn't necessarily mean that you're an introvert. And those of us who are extroverts and still writers often love the speaking part of it. And you can tell the difference if you go to a book signing. You know, the writers who are just writers and wonderful, magnificent, exquisite writers will stand behind that podium shaking. They will keep their eyes down on their book and read until their 14 minutes is up and then mercifully be able to move away. You can tell they're just not having a good time. And then there are the ones, like me, who are sitting there on the edge of the table having the best time. So you kind of know if you want to take words in both directions.
Oh, that's great. Do you have a final tip you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think the same thing that I've heard those actors say to young actors. If you can possibly do anything else in terms of for your living, oh, please do, because it will make your writing fly to not feel like you're counting on it to make a living. But if this is what you do, if you are in this with both feet, hands, head, and this is your life, then trust it. Every single day, write some words. They don't have to be fabulous. Just make sure you do it. Do it at the time of day that's best for you, when you know the muse is going to get to you, and trust yourself that those words are going to get out there and reach their audience.
That's great. Thank you so much, Victoria. This was wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
This has been another edition of Always Right with Rochelle, the Right Now Coach. You can find a link to Victoria's website and her books at my website, rightnowcoach.com. Thanks for tuning in, and remember to always write.